Welcome to the Reaction Podcast, me, Alistair Ben. This week I'm joined by Polly McKenzie, who is director of Demos, a cross-party think tank. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having Polly.
We decided to launch a thing from Demos called the Optimism Project, which at first reading for me sounded a bit like one of those sort of transhumanist projects to transcend death or to put our brains into formaldehyde. But that's not it, is it?
It's not it. There's no brains involved, or at least not disembodied ones. So the thinking was that, actually this is a project, even though it's called Optimism, which was born of despair, a sense of a paralysing helplessness in the face of a politics which is, I guess, spinning out of control. And there's sort of two responses you can have. One is to hide, to retreat, to kind of just personal life. And the other is to think, okay, how do we stop this? How do we find a way to end what I've been calling the age of outrage and find a new pathway to, I guess, a process of reconciliation for the nation, whether that is across generational divides, across religious and racial divides, this, you know, believers, remainers divide. I kind of start from a presumption that a country cannot go on being this angry with itself. There's a sort of something I originally heard from a comic, but I thought is spot on, which is that before the referendum, the leavers were angry, and now everyone is angry. I don't think we can do that. And so what I wanted to do with the Optimism Project is just start a process of finding out how we can go back to a sense that politics has a purpose, that the country has an identity that we can feel cheerful and positive about. So this is intended to be a kind of year-long project. This is just the first piece of research that we're doing, which we've done in conjunction with Opinium. And we found that there is still some optimism in Britain, and it's focused particularly around the stuff that is close to people, their neighbourhood, their community and their family, and that what's letting us all down, actually, is our politics, our divided politics. It's that that people are most gloomy about.
The things that people seem to be positive about are things that they can control. They are various aspects of like the national symbol mythology, like the monarchy. Those things don't seem to me to be the basis on which you can build like a national vision of economic transformation.
I think there's a whole series of things that might be going on driving why people feel more cheerful about the stuff that's close to them. I mean, first, it might just be a cognitive bias. They might just be less able to make rational judgments about things that are closer to them than they are about the fate of the nation as a whole, which is more easy to sort of statistically analyse. But I don't think it's just that. I think it's also, as you were saying, about a sense of power and agency and a sense of proximity and a sense of understanding. Even on this question of political division, we know there are families up and down the country who've been kind of split down the middle by the Leave-Remain argument, but nevertheless what people told us is they still love those people, they still want to be in their family, and most people give credence to other people's good motivations. And so I think we can actually build a sense of national purpose around some of those things. Demos has done in the past bucket loads of work around giving people more agency within public services through personal budgets, expert patient communities, those kinds of things. Perhaps if people felt that they had more agency in the NHS or as citizens in our democracy, they might feel less gloomy about it. I think there's also the question of if people feel close to stuff they have a personal relationship with, well, why don't we think about the way in which the state has a role in encouraging people to have relationships with other people? You know, something that I know is controversial, but never ceases to amaze me is that we not only allow but increasingly encourage racial and religious segregation in our schools instead of trying to encourage people to come together as both kids and then, you know, parents in the playground. We have kind of a few pilot job clubs where people who are job seekers come together and collaborate in the process of looking for a job, but that's actually the exception, whereas the rule is that Universal Credit is now an online service whereby you don't even get a dole queue, which means, you know, absurdly, you know, you can't even have a sort of full Monty type interaction where people start talking to their neighbours and people in the same boat. And so thinking about another strand of Demos work over the course of 25 years has been the question of relational public services. Perhaps that's an answer to getting us to feel positive and optimistic. I think there have been times when people have felt cheerful about politics. Just to quote yet another Demos pamphlet, in 1997-98 we wrote this thing called Cool Britannia, which now feels horribly dated and about a bit like Friends, you know, just sort of old. But that was a sense that Britain had an identity. I think Blair said at the time, Britain is a young country, which is both absurd and yet had a sense of truth about it, I think. We need to find a way to rebuild that sense of purpose and identity. And the answer is not, this project, right, is not about blindly being optimistic. It's about hunting for optimism and trying to build it.
So there's Cool Britannia.
Yeah.
The London Olympics 2012 is often cited. I always feel a bit of doubt about that narrative, because 2012 was a sequence of elaborate fictions which were already unravelling in that year, and through those years we already had massive turn towards outrage through electoral outcomes at local elections, particularly like UKIP, the BNP. Even in Cool Britannia, you know, it was a very shallow vision of Britain in lots of ways, that you could like connect politics to entertainment.
But it was also a sense that soft power had a role in Britain's purpose in the world, which I think it is a more lasting legacy that was then undermined very significantly, of course, by the disasters of kind of late Blair foreign policy. You can't find all of the answers in the past, of course, and I too don't have particularly sunny memories of 2012 because I had a very small baby at the time and I spent most of the summer feeling sleepless and in tears. But there has to be a sense of national purpose, I think. A sense of a demos, of a shared identity. And that is something where I think lots of us have gone wrong in the past. Of thinking that there doesn't need to be a way for people to come together, because so long as you're not hurting anybody else, it's sort of classical liberal argument, then you should be allowed to do what you want. And that's fine up to a point, but when people don't talk to each other, outrage is what ensues. And I don't think that the country can be sustained on that.
How does that fit in with, for example, the picture of the devolved nations? Because maybe that's the problem. I don't think Scotland actually is that of a particularly pessimistic place. I mean, growing up there, I felt that the atmosphere is actually very different, a lot more generous, for example, towards minorities.
I think that's right, and I think Scotland has very successfully built a vision of Scottishness that's much more inclusive than Englishness is.
Yeah.
I think that's there's a job of work to be done around Englishness to build that, because people, of course, shouldn't feel ashamed or embarrassed to be English as well as British. I think it's slightly, where I'm from in Wales, it's slightly more different. Slightly less inclusive, and you know, Wales still has a sense of you know, a real kind of poverty and a lack of economic opportunity, which is very problematic and not a proper government of its own. And for all of the things that I don't really like about the SNP, I think they have been part of a narrative about a Scottish identity that I don't think Plaid Cymru has, partly because they're so invested in just the Welsh language, which means that you end up being quite exclusionary to those who don't speak it.
Yeah.
But I think it's multi-layered. You know, I'm proud of all the different places that I'm from. Now, I'm from more places than most people, having been to 7 schools and lived in 14 houses in my first 18 years of life. But we're all from somewhere, and people do feel a sense of pride in their village or their town or their city. That civic sense of identity can then be part of a national, and then again, it should still, I think, feel okay to feel European. I do feel European, and I think if this report sort of demonstration that people feel much more optimistic about community and about relationships is probably a sense of identity that helps them to give them that positivity, and if we can build that sense of identity at all of the different layers of our government, perhaps we can build that sense of purpose at those different those places where it's absent, like in national life.
That force that could build a kind of layered sense of togetherness, I just don't see, and this is an extremely pessimistic vision, I realise that, I can't see beyond a picture that has become so fragmented.
that's because
That atmosphere of mistrust is so hard to reverse when the resources seem to be in so many different places.
Yeah, so I agree. There's a question of what do you do with that, right? Do you wring your hands and complain and say it's all impossible? That's just not really my personality. It's incredibly difficult. And there's a huge absence of leadership here. But I think that's really what's missing, is that we have got two main parties, and then all of the small ones as well, who all have a view that there should be unity of everybody else behind them. And we've seen that from the Prime Minister a lot, a sense, there's a national sense of coming together, you have to agree with me, crush the saboteurs. You see it for, you know, sort of Labour cabinet, a shadow cabinet member I was talking to said to me, oh, this cross-party thing you're trying to do, that won't work, we're aiming for total hegemony. No, I'm not, like, that's just not, I just don't think that democracy should be relinquished to the tyranny of the majority. We have to find a way of doing it better. It doesn't make it easy. And there does need to be a political leader or several political leaders who are willing to collaborate, to compromise without a starting presumption that that means everybody else has to agree with them.
Yeah. Well, it's like a romantic vision, isn't it? You're going from decades and decades of essentially technocratic leaders who basically subscribe to a broadly a kind of soft liberal outlook that politics is about balancing things, that there are institutions which have some powers, the popular will does, you know, affect some things, that these are kind of held in a mishmash of interests. And then you have someone like Corbyn or the hard Brexiteer side of the Tory party who really think that politics is about transforming ethical life, making people's relationships better.
I think you're definitely right. We've been through an age of very, very red book politics where, you know, most policies are really, I mean, primarily about cuts, but also just about stuff that happens in spreadsheets. And what we have, I think, learned from Brexit and from a whole other set of changes in our society is that people are much less interested in those kind of red book spreadsheet politics than they are in a sense of purpose and identity. What troubles me as somebody who is not an extremist is that people, those who have successfully talked about identity, have done it by finding some other people who they are opposed to, so that generating your own sense of identity has been about driving out people in burqas or people who are Polish or whatever it is. It's about finding an other and constructing your identity in opposition to them. What I believe is possible, though not easy, is to find a sense of identity that can be constructed more positively without having enemies, because I don't think it's a zero-sum game. I think that inclusive sense of identity that you've identified in Scotland is within our reach. And so some of the things that give me hope from our research are that this fact that people give credence to even their political opponents for having good motivations. You know, that's a helpful starting place because political activists don't. You know, I've lost track of the number of times I've been accused of being a murderer or of being evil because of some decision that the coalition government, where I worked as an advisor, made. You know, and nobody changes their mind because they've just been accused of being a murderer for a policy change that they made. I think we can do better than screaming and shouting at each other, and I think that is what people want. And the other thing that gives me hope is actually from the sort of qualitative element of our research, which is that the stuff that people are excited about, we've talked about sport, but actually is about our green spaces, parks, community life, that civic space, which we know is under a lot of threat from changes in technology that change the kind of economic base of things like high streets or cafes and places where people can physically come together. And it's something that politics hasn't traditionally talked about, is, you know, building parks is a really important kind of top 10 thing for government to care about, rather than something which, oh, well, the parish council will do it or not do it, and who cares about the bins? A sense that actually some of the stuff which politics thinks is unimportant is immeasurably important to people. And perhaps we need to foreground some of that stuff. I think it's one of the reasons why Michael Gove is doing well as Environment Secretary, is because he hasn't gone, oh, I've got a really rubbish department, I'm just going to sort of sit it out till I get promoted, like most DEFRA secretaries. He's gone, oh my goodness, how exciting, and is just looking for stuff to do, and that has included, you know, stuff on national parks. He'll probably be talking about birds and wetlands next.
Yeah.
You know, it's a truism of political life that all these people are members of the National Trust and the RSPB, and they're not members of political parties. Well, maybe politics should actually just try and get into that business.
Yeah.
If you want people to like you, instead of talking about spreadsheets.
You know, everyone's going on about how worn out the way we talk about politics is, that the old words don't function anymore. You know, people go endlessly have this fantasy sense that things are not making up. You know, words aren't really attached to things in quite the way that they did, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
But in really, for me, that is an enormous opportunity, because you can be, it really loosens things up.
So I remember David Cameron, before he was Prime Minister, I think, had a go at Smith's for having chocolate oranges for sale on the counter, as a really annoying sort of nudge to encourage people to just eat way too much chocolate. And I remember at the time thinking, oh, who does he think he is? There's nothing to do with him. You know, what are you going to regulate to ban chocolate sales at the counter? But actually, maybe it's now just because I've got kids, so I've been pestered at checkouts enough. There has been a real cultural move. Smith's is now one of the few places where you get chocolate at the checkout. Like supermarkets, you know, just surrounded by healthy seed bars and nuts and things. And that is a good change, which is about more than just a government regulation. And I think Cameron was both right and brave to set the kind of territory for politics as including kind of ethical and cultural questions. And I thought he was wrong at the time, and I've come to the conclusion latterly that he was right, and politics should do more of that, not less.
Unfortunately, I do think there is someone pulling off precisely those very complex moves which mediate between, as you described, the layers of national, local, international loyalties. Is that Macron, for all his faults, and there are many, has both realised that your messaging doesn't actually have to be consistent. You don't have to actually have a completely coherent view of politics that you just project domestically and abroad. You can go to America and make a speech that is all about defending liberal democracy, environmentalism, and then you can come back to France and make a speech making the most angry attacks on union leaders, or saying that Corsicans have no right to have self-determination, all these like extremely authoritarian kind of attitudes. And he can also, so there's that aspect to it, and then he kind of laces it together with talking about the French past in a very distinctive way that is both Republican and also modern. He talks about modern conflicts by referring back into France's historical role, both as an aggressor and as someone who's helped out. And you start building up a picture of a guy who's, again, mediating between the very difficult domestic problems he has, particularly in terms of identity, the threat of, you know, a very aggressive attitude towards minorities, you know, an economic base which is really unproductive and exclusionary. And, you know, I guess I'm kind of rambling because I'm a sort of Macron Uber fan. But, you know, there is a way of doing that.
Yeah.
But and this is kind of where I'm a bit more pessimistic, is that that seems to be happening in France because they do have always had a pretty grandiloquent way of talking about politics, a very raucous public sphere that is also very highly informed. People talk about politics everywhere in France. It's from doorstep to the Elysee Palace. Everyone is fascinated by politics, and there's a massive amount of distrust of the establishment, but that doesn't mean people aren't invested in like the 19th century politics of the left, or you know, like the left is like a religion in some parts of France, like, and that is still a kind of reality there. But in Britain, I just wonder whether that public debate that is really vibrant and etc. has become so kind of diluted by managerialism, or so far removed because of a real lack of any local democracy, like in a meaningful way. And how you reverse that? How do you think, for example, stuff like the mayoral elections is like a distinctively British way of squaring that?
Well, it's certainly true that we don't really have enough democracy in the UK. you know, the number of elected politicians per head is tiny in comparison with somewhere like France, where, you know, you have mayors of even every tiny village. Yeah. And that people need to have an experience whereby their political opinion and their political engagement has an impact in order to feel a sense that it's worth it. You know, voting's not exactly an exciting experience, you know. And so if you endlessly feel that doing it doesn't make any difference because you're voting for a government and most votes don't matter, why would you bother? You know, actually, if there are planning decisions are made by the local mayor about your village, and so you have to get involved, I think people have a sort of develop a muscle memory that it's worth participating. And whether it's through more elected officials, more referenda, I think it's about a mix. We need to reform our everyday democracy, give people more chances for kind of civic participation. A sense that all power needs to be arrogated to the central state is problematic. You know, mayors are helpful, I think, even though, you know, at the big city, like having a mayor of the West Midlands is kind of a mad thing to have done. Nevertheless, it helps to create a body and a person to whom power can be invested that people recognise, that can hopefully start to just rebuild a sense of politics having a purpose. And because we have this unbelievably sort of stressed and panicky treasury that doesn't like giving power to anybody, they're at least big enough to allow the treasury to let go of some of the purse strings. Because obviously, you know, if you started talking about devolving power to parish councils, they'd have a complete conniption, I think.
Yeah. You talk about an encounter with politics, and I think that's an interesting way of framing it. I wonder how that maps onto the kind of intergenerational grievances that you mentioned earlier. And I, you know, from a personal perspective, mm-hmm. I've mentioned kind of experiencing politics as a kind of managerial, quite boring thing. It's also experienced as quite a traumatic thing. So 9/11 is literally the first thing I remember happening. That wasn't my school, home, family life. Over the last 15 years, the big kind of geopolitical events have been ones that speak of failure, national humiliation, overextensions of power, like overconfidence in what we can do in the world. In the UK, there's nothing that predicts your voting outcome more than age.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to me to mark off the future or the generation that is about to come to maturity and about to engage more into public life from, for example, even people who are in their 30s and 40s who maybe remember the Berlin Wall coming down, who remember the 90s, or who remember kind of Cool Britannia.
So, I mean, maybe that's a divide between me and you, because I do remember the Berlin Wall coming down and a sense of hope and purpose and that history was going in the right direction.
Mm.
I think there's all sorts of drivers around this, I guess, millennial malaise, as you put it.
The sense is that history has no direction. Like, you know, there really isn't that things are going to collapse into nationalisms or collapse into big power politics.
Yeah. So it's interesting, actually, in this research, the one area that people, that one kind of voters that people thought probably had bad motivations were nationalist voters.
Okay.
People suspicious of SNP voters and UKIP voters and Plaid Cymru voters. I think there is a sense that nationalism is still not the sort of the most popular thing. And, you know, you're talking about Macron. It's interesting, you know, a huge amount of his support just came from him not being a nationalist and people saying, actually, I don't want that to be our identity. However many sort of heartstrings it might pull to talk about,
you
know, sort of nostalgic love of, I don't know, pure white France or whatever it might be. I think within the UK, millennial anger is associated substantially with the housing crisis. Yeah. Whereas, you know, there's other countries in Europe whereby youth unemployment is massively high and still a source of huge anger. Within the UK context, though, I think there are ways to think about policy that can bring generations together. So we did a report last year about building later life housing, you know, on a massive scale. Actually, you know, hardly any really is built. And yet 50, 60% of people over 50 say they would like to move into a retirement community. If you built enough for 50 or 60% of people to move, you would improve their lives because you don't fall down the stairs in a properly adapted house. It's better heated. We don't have to pay the heating bills and the council tax like we do for so many older people. And you also free cash, because when people downsize, they have lots more money to spend, which means they can live a more comfortable life. And you free up housing for younger people. Now, that's one example. But I feel like it ought not to be beyond the wit of clever policy people to think about ways that you can create policies that operate in the common interest so that the intergenerational problems aren't seen as a conflict, but yeah. as
And you don't have politicians who just appeal to one side of that divide.
Yeah.
Because there are, you know, that's, you know, the genius of what Corbyn managed to pull off was just very, I mean, he knows he gets, you know, a certain number of people from the old kind of working class areas,
mm-hmm.
but then to just really go for just, you know, these people don't represent you, they will just sort out housing, we've got these big,
it was extraordinary actually when actually Theresa May had been braver, potentially stupidly braver than anybody else in terms of her challenge to the assets of older people with her social care policy, which meant that, of course, unfortunately, without managing to appeal to the young, she managed to upset enough old people to lose her majority.
Kind of talking more broadly, is the Optimism Project, does it take in things like ameliorating the excesses of the free market?
I mean, this is a sort of framing project for the role that Demos hopes to play in our national life, which is about reconciliation and dialogue. Demos has always focused on listening and engaging to people. I think one of the things that scares me actually about politics is that the extremists and the centrists are actually united in a really bleak vision of what people think. They both believe the worst of human nature. The extremists pander to it, and the centrists roll their eyes in despair and say things like, oh, well, maybe we've had enough of democracy.
Yeah. It's just manipulation.
Exactly. Yes. Oh, it's all fake news, or it's all, let's blame the Russians. Maybe I'm hopelessly naive, but I believe that even people who are angry are not just angry. And if you take this, the obviously absurd contradiction of, say, the Daily Mail campaigning against immigration at every turn, and then having the front page that is saying that Windrush is a scandal. Mm. Or the endless examples you find of people who are sort of anti-refugees and then campaign to get protection for the Syrian family who live in their street because they're their neighbours. You can despair of people's irrational, confusing ideologies, mm. or you can say, actually, even among people who might have instincts that we don't like, there's something to build on. And I believe that there is. And you can have that conversation. That's the next kind of wave of research that we're raising money for, is to have that conversation with the most angry, the most disenfranchised people. What happens if you get those people from different sides of these divides in a room together and ask them to find solutions instead of to shout at each other? Because I believe that is possible. You can't prejudge the outcome. And there will, of course, always be some people who do just want to, whatever it is, kill the Jews, slaughter the old people, drive out the blacks, whatever it is. Those people are wrong and they need to be defeated, but most people aren't like that. Most people are capable of collaborating with even their political opponents and finding common cause. And we need to start that process, otherwise we will just end up divided and potentially in a state of kind of political collapse. And that's when things fall apart.